From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio are in. The Senate gets into the Iran deal. We've got Cuba, Pacific trade, and a gyrocopter on the Capitol lawn. Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio make it official. They're each running for president.
I'm getting ready to do something, too. I'm running for president.
Yesterday is over. And we're never going back.
A Senate committee vote puts Congress in the middle of the Iran nuclear deal. Here's Republican Senator Bob Corker.
It forces the administration to bring to us every detail, if there happens to be a final agreement, every detail.
And a gyrocopter with a Florida mailman on board lands on the Capitol lawn as tourists take in the scene. Here's ABC's Jim Avella.
The gyrocopter flew over the reflecting pool.
This is not good, people.
Past the statue of Ulysses S. Grant, dozens watching as it made a beeline for the Capitol.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Sanger of the New York Times, Rachel Smolkin of CNN Politics, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? Are you getting your own gyrocopter? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
Wonderful to have you. And from Washington, Rachel Smolkin joins us, executive editor at CNN Politics. Rachel, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much. Great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Rachel.
There was no surprise in it. Mailman, Florida mailman Doug Hughes told the Tampa Bay Times, here he is in a video, he was going to do exactly what he did, and here's why.
I'm going to violate the no-fly zone nonviolently. I intend for nobody to get hurt, and I'm going to land on the Capitol Mall in front of the Capitol building. I'm going to have 535 letters strapped to the landing gear in boxes. And those letters are going to be addressed to every member of Congress.
Amazing. We're glad it was just letters strapped to the landing gear, and landed he did. We all saw it. Plenty of video of this. We'll look at the politics of this, Rachel, but David Sanger, you're a national security correspondent. How is it that a guy can fly from Gettysburg all the way across all that territory, right up the Capitol Mall and onto the lawn of the Capitol? Is this another one of these, oh, what is happening with our nation's Capitol security moments?
Well, yes and no, Tom. You know, the phrase under the radar didn't come up for nothing. When you've got something that is that small and can fly that low, you can fly under the radar. That's what it means. That also means that there's relatively little threat from something that is that small. It can't carry a huge amount of explosive. He was probably lucky from the look of this very, very small helicopter that it could carry the weight of the letters that he was bringing to Congress. But it does tell you that we've got some vulnerabilities. I mean, think just about the past couple of months. We've had a U.S. actually intelligence agency official who had a little bit too much to drink and was flying around what some people now call a drone. And when we were kids, you probably would have called a radio-controlled airplane that ended up on the White House lawn.
Yep.
He's still employed. The Postal Service worker may not be employed. He's probably lucky to be alive because he came in the middle of the day. And I suspect that had he stayed in the air or gotten a whole lot closer to the Capitol, probably he would have gone into very rapid descent. Is there a threat from all of this? Yes. When you think about the other threats that we face, from hijacked airplanes to cyber, is it a significant threat? No.
Lucky to be alive. He's facing charges now. He could face up to 4 years in prison plus fines, we're told, but he's out of jail on his own recognizance. Rachel Smolkin, what about his issue? All the 500-plus letters to the members of Congress on his landing gear. Is there an audience for taking up campaign spending, money politics in that Congress right now?
Absolutely not. And whatever attention he hoped to raise for this issue has instead quickly pivoted, as David said, to vulnerabilities in the nation's capital and a debate about media ethics. So it was not in any way successful in focusing the national debate on campaign finance reform, although that is a topic that you'll hear in passing as 2016 kicks into gear. We've heard Hillary Clinton and Chris Christie and others refer to money in politics. But that's certainly not a defining issue, at least thus far, of the election, and not where the conversation is going to go about the incident last week.
A lot of Americans concerned about it. What's the media ethics problem, Rachel?
The media ethics problem, and this is something that got a lot of attention, is that the Tampa Bay Times knew almost a year ago about this flight plan. And in fact, a reporter from the Tampa Bay Times traveled to Washington this week to watch it all unfold. So the question that very quickly came up is, what is the media's responsibility when faced with something like this? Is it to the story or is it to alert authorities, which in this case happened very, very late?
But I wasn't aware that Tampa Bay kept it a secret, did they, the newspaper?
Well, there's keeping it a secret, and then there's going to the authorities and saying ahead of time, this is what happened. And that's where the debate has come. The newspaper defended its actions, said that they felt that they were very comfortable with the way they had handled it. They didn't think that this guy was any kind of a threat. But a number of prominent media ethicists weighed in to say, actually, this is not how this is supposed to go. And the paper was not in a position to assess what kind of threat this guy is or is not.
Jack Beatty, I have to say, I kind of admire mailman Hugh's gumption here. If it had been a real threat, that's another thing. He seems like a pretty mild-mannered guy with a complaint that a lot of Americans share. It lets us think about security in the Capitol, and it surely prompts us, once again, to think about the issue he raises. We're going to talk about it more on Monday, but big money politics in this country.
Yes, and he's a kind of bizarre patriot in his way. He says, tell the Tampa Tribune, I've thought about walking away from this whole thing, campaign finance, because it's crazy. Well, something is crazy. But I also have thought about being 80 years old and watching the collapse of this country and thinking that I had an idea once that might have arrested the fall, interesting choice of words,
yes.
And I didn't do it. And I will tell you completely honestly, I'd rather die in the flight than live to be 80 years old and see this country fall.
It will be so interesting to see how his case plays out. But what a big impression he made this week. Of course, the politics very much on. Formally,
Tom, the best line I heard about this was from one U.S. official who said it actually does show that the Postal Service is willing to go to any length to actually deliver
this. Yeah, and indeed he did. I still, David,
I'm not sure the Postal Service will appreciate that line too much.
I remain unpersuaded, David, that somehow there was a whole lot of, you know, hair trigger security just standing by, not firing on this because it didn't look like a threat. It looks to me like under the radar, not the Capitol doesn't seem that well defended. It's just my impression for people jumping over fences, running into the White House, flying onto the Capitol lawn, and we're still supposed to believe that there's some great umbrella of security here that just has chosen not to go into action.
Yeah, but the other risk, Tom, is if you have something that's flying that low, and let's say you go after it with some kind of missile or arms fire to go take it down, your chance of actually injuring other people in the process of doing that, because you're not shooting something very high, is pretty high. So it takes a fair bit of discipline to go evaluate whether the threat is actually worth opening fire on something.
Fair enough. And we heard all those school kids visiting right there by the reflecting pool. Thomas in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Thomas, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to bring to the panel the issue sort of related with the 22-year-old man who shot himself on the Capitol steps earlier this month with a tax the 1% sign. It seems like we've got a number of these events, and every time they come to light, the media just sort of spins it off to, you know, away from what their grievance was and on to, you know, how crazy these people supposedly are. And I just wanted to bring that to the panel and get their thoughts, and I'll take my response off the air.
Thomas, I appreciate your call. And, of course, that's a sad story of a man who shot himself on the Capitol steps with that tax the 1% sign. I mean, there's just no way of seeing that as other than sad, ultimately. We're going to pick up our mailman's complaint on Monday right here, so we're not writing him off as a crazy guy.
But it is kind of crazy, Rachel, when people feel they have to go to such extent to raise their voicing and get their message, get their issue, in the spotlight.
It's become both easier with the advent and development of social media for anyone to break through into the conversation, and also harder. There's so much noise, so many competing voices for attention. You started by focusing on the original goal of the pilot, which was to call attention to big money in politics and campaign finance reforms. And many people would argue that our system has become so dominated by big corporate interests and big money that perhaps people feel that they're being driven to greater lengths to make their voices heard if they're not among those powerful.
We heard about a potential $2 billion-plus Clinton campaign this year. Are both parties equally deep in this fundraising river, Rachel?
It's impossible to run for president without being very deep into the fundraising river. The question is, what donations are you accepting, and what disclosures are you making around the donations as we see more and more dark money, as we see super PACs, as we see super PACs teaming in new ways, which we have already seen with Senator Ted Cruz and his ability to raise money very quickly in new ways. So we will continue to see, as this election goes on, the next development of the big money race. But the only question is where that's going to go and what the new wrinkle will be. It is not a question of will we see big money. We absolutely will.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news with David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, Rachel Smolkin, executive editor for CNN Politics, and our own Jack Beatty. We've got Hillary, Rubio, Congress and the Iran deal, low-wage protests, and the gyrocopter comes in for a landing. Of course, it was last Sunday, Hillary Clinton formally announcing, after all kinds of anticipation, in a video online.
The deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than just get by. You can get ahead and stay ahead.
She wants to be your champion. Hopped in a van, drove to Iowa. NBC News reporter Kristen Welker tried to ask her about her Iowa strategy as she got back into that van. Scooby, she calls it. You hear Welker, then Hillary Clinton.
Secretary Clinton, you
are.
Hi.
Nice to see you. Great to walk you.
Iowa in 2008. How do you win this time? What's your strategy?
I'm having a great time. Can't look forward any more than I am. Thank you.
What did you learn in 2008, Secretary Clinton?
Rachel, is she having a great time?
She definitely was able to project that this week. I won't speculate about what's going on inside, but it was a week where she really put that sense of fun out more than we saw a little more in the last campaign. We saw a couple of themes emerge very quickly this past week. The first is that she's really trying hard to run a more humble campaign than she did the last time, to erase that sense of inevitability that she was criticized so heavily for the last time around, and incidentally, that it didn't work out very well for her the last sense around. So she's really trying to project this sense of this campaign is not about her, and she's really trying to earn each and every vote. We saw that in Iowa. We saw it with her introductory video in which she played almost a supporting role. It was really not a video all about her, and of course, that was done very intentionally by her campaign. The other theme that we saw and that we in the media took part in is that every single action because of Hillary Clinton's celebrity and enormous name recognition will be intensely magnified, whether that is a closed circuit television of her standing in a Chipotle or the absurd running of the reporters or a comment she makes about immigrant grandparents that gets immediately fact-checked and heavily scrutinized. So these are two storylines that we will see over and over and over in this campaign.
Jack Beatty, I was at a taping last night of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me in Boston. Of course, they always have fun with all the news. They looked at this video and saw a Cialis ad. It wasn't hard to see that. But what about it? The message there, the method, this first week of Hillary Clinton formally in the race. We'll look at Rubio, but Hillary Clinton first formally in the race. What'd you see, Jack?
Well, what I saw was John Podesta's tweet announcing her candidacy. He's her campaign manager. The tweet reads, "Helping working families succeed, building small businesses, tackling climate change and green energy." That last, tackling climate change and green energy, that caught many people's eye because that's almost historic, making a candidate giving it that promise, that prominence. Hillary and Barack Obama both acknowledged it in 2008, but the relevant campaign really was fought on other issues. Al Gore avoided it in 2000, John Kerry in 2004, both Obama and Romney in 2012. You know, we can't know how the Republicans are going to come down on global warming, but the Koch brothers aren't paying for ambiguity. You know, Hillary's record, when you look at it, on climate issues is a mixed one. On the one hand, she strongly supports President Obama's new EPA regulations on power plants. On the other, she routinely ducks questions on the Keystone Pipeline. On the one hand, she says the science of climate change, quote, is unforgiving, no matter what the deniers say. On the other, she promoted fracking as Secretary of State and oil, the interests of oil companies abroad. Recently, International Business Times ran an expose about a Canadian oil company that was accused of human rights violations in Colombia. I quote, "After millions of dollars were pledged by the oil company to the Clinton Foundation, Secretary Clinton abruptly changed her position and supported the controversial U.S.-Colombia trade pact," end quote. The head of that oil company now just happens to sit on the board of the Clinton Foundation. The point is, she'll raise this issue, but the Republicans have some ammunition to call attention to her feet of clay. Perhaps.
We will no doubt hear more on that front and others. David Sanger, you've been watching a long time. How do you see Secretary Clinton, Madam Hillary Clinton, lined up this time?
Well, you know, it's a long, long way from operating as Secretary of State, where she immersed herself in some of the most complex security and foreign policy issues, the Arab Spring and so forth, to showing up at a Chipotle on your way to Iowa. And by the way, there's a Chipotle not far from the State Department, and I never saw her in it once during that time. And it tells you what a change it's got to be when you have to move from the issues that clearly occupied her over the past 6 years, or at least the first four of the administration, to what she's got to go do to win the nomination. Once the campaign gets beyond the silly season of following the Scooby van and we actually get into real discussion, then I think it's going to be an interesting moment to see the degree to which the secretary runs on basically the Obama record and the degree to which she tries to go separate herself from it. Now, Jack raised some of these issues on climate change. But clearly, when you looked at that video, she was running with the Obama record. I mean, the video included a gay couple. The video included somebody who seemed to say that the biggest issue they were facing was keeping the dog eating from the trash. It was very supposed to be a sort of down-home video. Once you get to the real campaign, the question is, does she stay with President Obama's dealings with ISIS? Does she endorse the way the Iran deal has been signed up, something that she, a negotiation she got going? And so there, I think the hard issues are all going to be how she defines herself separate from Obama so that people are not accusing her of basically trying a third term of the Obama administration without divorcing herself from what's given her her greatest credential.
Let's hear from the other big announcement this week, Marco Rubio. Of course, he was in Florida announcing formally he's running for president and maybe having jabs along the way. We'll hear more of that. But at yesterday's candidates, I don't know if that's Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton or both. Here's Monday, Senator Marco Rubio.
America doesn't owe me anything. But I have a debt to America I must try to repay. This isn't just the country where I was born. America is literally the place that changed my family's history.
And yesterday, said the 43-year-old, looking at some older candidates maybe, yesterday's over.
Just yesterday, a leader from yesterday began a campaign for president by promising to take us back to yesterday. Yesterday is over.
Marco Rubio saying formally he's in. Rachel Smolka, we've got several now in on the GOP side. How is Senator Rubio positioned here?
Senator Rubio came in with a very strong speech this week. There were a lot of questions going in about whether he would be completely overshadowed by the Hillary Clinton video rollout frenzy around all of that. Instead, he really took it. We just heard the sound about yesterday. He really took this and used it to his advantage as best he could and used it as a way to frame his own message, to frame this as an election that is a generational choice and to position himself as the candidate of the future, the candidate of tomorrow. Rubio has a very compelling personal story. He's a good speaker. His issue is, where is his support going to come from? He's seen as very charismatic, but right now, and of course, we're very, very early, so take any poll with a major grain of salt, but he's right in the middle of the pack on the polls. He has not broken out yet. As we look at the GOP field, his positioning as the candidate of the future allows him to take jabs not just at Hillary Clinton, which we saw in a very direct way, but in a slightly more subtle way at his big competition on the Republican side, and that is, of course, Jeb Bush, who is also, like Clinton, a grandparent and had his a fourth grandchild this week.
And said he doesn't need to go to Chipotle. He's got his, south of the border food at home. Carlos in Austin, Texas. Carlos, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just had a quick comment about the Marco Rubio and also Ted Cruz nominations. I feel like the media sort of gives them way more credibility than they probably deserve. I don't think either one of them has a real chance to go very far in the campaign.
But how can you say that, Carlos? They're both U.S. senators. They've got a pretty prominent platform. Barack Obama went from a similar platform to the White House.
Well, I don't think, you know, establishment, supporting older white demographic Republicans are going to come out in droves for those guys. I think Ted Cruz is too divisive, and I think he'll kind of implode under the scrutiny that comes with a longer campaign. Plus, I just think that the media gravitates towards these quick soundbite kind of platitudes, but neither one of them have positions, I think, that speak broadly to Americans as a whole. I also just think that, you know, there's a little bit of this, the media kind of saying there's a demographic shift going on with the Latino voters, and that's something that the Republicans need to take seriously. But if you look at someone like Marco Rubio, the guy doesn't say anything that speaks to Latino voters, myself included. I think, you know, Cuban Americans and his position on, a relationship, the warming relationship with Cuba right now speaks to sort of an older viewpoint.
He says he would turn it around, turn it back, have none of it.
And he doesn't do anything about the pressing issue for most of us. You know, the majority of Latinos in this country are Mexican-American. And whether or not we were born in this country like me and my family, all of us have ties to Mexico, all of us have ties to immigrants, and the guy has terrible positioning on the immigration policies. He just doesn't speak to any of us on that level at all. You know, we can see right through the last name stuff. This has been going on since Reagan. He's trotting out a reactionary Cuban American to supposedly represent Latinos. Come on, that's 1980 politics.
Carlos, you may be exactly right over time. We will watch and see and remember you as prescient if you are. But of course, here they are getting in, and they're going to be covered when they announce Marco Rubio seen as a big up-and-comer. How it plays out over time, you may be right. We'll watch and see. We're looking at a week in the news. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I think the Democrats need to have put some other candidates in the ring so they can have some dialogue among themselves, or otherwise they're going to be in real trouble.
Jack Beatty, what do you say?
Well, the sound of one hand clapping, it's not going to, it's going to be a long, long time before Hillary gets some contestation unless someone comes forward. But if I may, let me go back to Carlos for a minute, Tom.
Yes, sure.
I don't think he was quite fair to Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio did sponsor, he's one of the sponsors, really the key person, immigration reform. Now he's backed away from it now. He says, well, we can't really do anything until we get the border secure. But that was taking a big political risk, and it was aimed, you know, that's really the big part of the Hispanic agenda. But, you know, when you look at him, some of his views have a distinctly old-time feel. Cuba, yesterday, citing a poll showing 61% of Republicans favor gay marriage, Marco doesn't. Jake Tapper told him, "You're the candidate of yesterday." Global warming, Marco says, "I'm no scientist, sounds like yesterday." His tax plan, which includes eliminating all federal taxes on capital gains, inherited estates, and interest income, that's Reaganomics on steroids.
Of course, this week we've got a House vote to get rid of the estate tax, so action on that front. There's going to be a long campaign season. We'll see a lot more turnout. I want to look at this Iran deal and the Senate getting in on it this week, Congress getting in on it. They've got a committee vote that will put them, with the White House standing down on a veto threat, right in the middle of the final negotiation over sanctions and more. Here was House Speaker John Boehner on Tuesday saying Congress has the right to review the Iran deal.
Congress absolutely should have the opportunity to review this deal. We shouldn't just count on the administration, who appears to want a deal at any cost.
Now, on Sunday, Secretary of State John Kerry had said Congress should not get involved in the Iran deal. There had been a kind of veto threat floating out there. Here was Kerry.
What we're looking for is not to have Congress interfere with our ability inappropriately by stepping on the prerogatives of the executive department, of the president, and putting in place conditions and terms that are going to get in the way of implementation of a plan.
But when they counted the numbers, it looked like the White House just went the other way. Here on Tuesday on Fox News, Republican Senator from Tennessee, Bob Corker, chairing the committee, detailed, he said, how the Secretary of State withdrew the administration's veto threat.
Secretary Kerry, in a classified setting, was pushing back strongly against this legislation. By 1 o'clock, they realized what was getting ready to happen. This was a runaway train. We had significant support. And so they released their veto threat once they saw that we were way beyond the number of people that would take to override a veto.
David Sanger, what happened here and what does it mean for the deal?
Well, what happened here, I think, as you just heard in that clip, is that the president and his aides learned how to count, and they discovered that the number that they were likely to come up with on their side of this deal, which was to basically keep Congress from doing a review for years to come, was about zero. So they did the most face-saving quick change that they could. That said, Tom, I think that the administration here totally lost the battle and may have won the war. And I say that for the following reason.
Mm-hmm.
First, Congress will not review anything and will not take action until after the June 30th deadline for the negotiations.
So they have room to make the deal.
Has happened. So they have room to go do this. And that was not, you know, a month ago, that was even 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. that was not at all evident. There were still threats Congress could act ahead of the deadline, which could well have scuttled the end of the talks. So that's number one. Number two is, Congress would, under this, look at the deal for the 30 days that followed the president's report that a deal had been struck. They would then have three choices. One would be to approve and go ahead. That would still leave them a vote later on sanctions, which I'll get to in a moment. The second would be to take no action, in which case the president's signature on the deal or the secretary's would go forward. Mm-hmm. And the third would be to reject it. Now, if they rejected it, the president could then veto that rejection. And to uphold the veto, he would only need 34 votes. There are 46 in the Senate, 46 Democrats. So there's almost no way that he has a risk here that Congress would undo whatever he negotiates.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Seattle-based Gravity Payments CEO Dan Price says CEO pay has gone too far. He's slashing his own from over $1 million so that everyone in his company will make at least $70,000. He described his employees' reactions.
I heard now I can have a baby. I heard now I can move out from my parents' house. I heard now I can live down the street from the office instead of having an hour commute. For me, it was the best money I've ever spent in my life.
Pay issue and one CEO stepping up. HBO's Game of Thrones returned with 8 million viewers and debuting the channel's standalone streaming service. HBO Now actors Peter Dinklage and Cornelith Hill mixed it up right away.
Drunken dwarf will never be the savior of the Seven Kingdoms.
I don't believe in saviors. I believe men of talent have a part to play in the war to come.
And R&B singer Percy Sledge died at 73. His biggest hit was his first in 1966, The Unforgettable, When a Man Loves a Woman.
When a man loves a woman, can't keep his mind on nothing else. He changed the world for the good thing he's found.
We're looking at a week in the news. Hillary, Rubio, Congress and the Iran deal, low-wage protests, and the gyrocopter pilot coming in for a landing. Rachel Smolkin is here, executive editor from CNN Politics. David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. Of course, it wasn't just Republicans in Congress getting into the action on the Iran deal. You had a lot of Democrats that the noses at the White House was counting there as well. On Tuesday, after the Senate Foreign Relations Committee met with Secretary of State John Kerry, ranking Democratic member Ben Cardin from Maryland talked about the Iran deal.
We are the ones who impose the sanctions. We're the ones who are going to have to take it up for permanent changes. So I would hope that the White House would recognize this is congressional prerogative that we have. If anything, reinforce the president's ability to negotiate, and there will be no action taken by Congress on the substance of the agreements till we receive the agreements. Congress can always take action. This gives us an orderly path forward. I would hope the administration would support that.
Rachel Smolkin, how do you interpret the politics of this move in Congress to get in, stay in the Iran deal? Is this driven by upset over the White House use of executive authority? Is it driven by just a cool analysis of the deal and how people see Iran? Is it driven by, we all saw Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu saying to Congress, don't do this? How big a factor is that?
Well, if that's A, B, and C, then the answer is definitely D, all of the above. As David said, the White House they looked at this and they saw that not just Republicans wanted to say in such a big, important moment, but Democrats did too. And we really saw Senator Cardin emerge as a very important voice on this week. He did get some concessions, some changes made in the bill that would make both Cardin himself and other Democrats and the White House comfortable. There were changes such as dropping the requirement that Iran declare it will not sponsor terrorism. At the same time, Cardin walked a careful political line saying they did not cave. They did not cave to say that they felt comfortable with the changes. That's, of course, as everything is in politics, part substance and part optics. And he was trying to manage through both of those things. So we saw those dynamics. The Democrats did want to get involved. We also saw a flavor of 2016 dynamics. We will see that in everything moving forward. We had been talking earlier about Senator Rubio and his position on Cuba and whether that is backwards looking or forward looking, what that means for generational shift. We've also seen him in relation to the Iran issue on Israel coming forward to say that he wants Iran to recognize Israel's right to exist. And then ultimately, this week, as the outlines of an agreement came forward, he agreed to stand down on that for now. We'll see if he brings it up again on the floor, as he suggested he might.
David Sanger, we saw the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, retired Admiral Mike Mullen, writing this week. He said, as of today, there is no more credible path of reducing the likelihood of Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon than this potential deal. Admiral Mullen said, those who say the risks are too high with the current deal offer no constructive path forward save the high potential for war. With Congress now in here, David, what are the odds of this deal, of the U.S. actually being able to go all the way with Iran and sign off on a deal? What are the odds of the deal coming to be?
Well, I think they're relatively good that the deal will come into effect. I think the question, as usually happens with these deals, is what happens in the implementation. I mean, we had a deal with North Korea in 94. We had another one during the Bush administration. Both of those collapsed. There's reason to believe that in the Iran case, compliance may well be better, especially because they have complied with just about everything, with one notable exception I'll get to in a moment, that they committed to do for the past 2 years in a temporary accord while this was being negotiated. But I think there are some significant risks ahead, which I've discussed in the past few days with all the major negotiators, both in the U.S. and among the allies. The first risk is this. You heard the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, come out last Thursday and say that all sanctions must be lifted immediately. And it is a bedrock principle for the Obama administration that you only lift the sanctions as the Iranians perform on their part of the obligations. There are ways around this, including having a deal that has a start date a number of months down the line and have the Iranians begin to comply in the run-up to that, that might be face-saving for both sides. But it's not clear whether that's negotiable. There are some other issues that he raised that I think could also be significantly problematic. And I think that Secretary Kerry and Secretary Ernest Moniz, the Energy Secretary, have concerns that when the Iranians come back to the negotiating table, they may say, you know, we took this back to Tehran and there's just a few things we need to reopen. But if they can get their way around all of that, I think the chances for a deal now have moved from 50-50 to probably much more like 70-30.
Let's go to Chris in Austin, Texas. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. My observation is that Article 2 specifically in the Constitution points to the executive having the ability to negotiate agreements. It isn't a treaty. And the failure of the Democrats in the Senate to stand behind the president and complicitly actually endorse some sort of not coming to an agreement with Iran. The sanctions haven't been effective in stopping the Iranian development of nuclear capabilities. So here's an opportunity to not put at risk more United States treasure, lives, and involvement in a Middle East conflict that never seems to come to a resolution that everyone kind of predicts may or may not come. You know, George Bush famously said, you know, Iraq would become this beacon of democracy. That hadn't happened. And the Democrats, in my opinion, failed the president, failed the country, more importantly, because it pushes on the executive. It doesn't allow the executive, as it says in Article 2, to negotiate with foreign countries and come into an agreement that could possibly keep us from an engagement with Iran. There is no other solution.
Chris, we've got it. Our time grows short, but I really appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, how do you read the Democrats stepping away from the White House on this?
Well, all nine of them voted against the White House. And as David brings out, this deal's, you know, bristles with complexities and things to object to. So let's stipulate that the nine voted their convictions. The trouble is convictions resist measurement. What can be measured are campaign contributions. In the 2014 cycle, the nine Democrats received roughly $1.5 million in contributions from what the public interest group MapLight calls, quote, pro-Israel groups. Robert Menendez led the pack, 340,000.
These are on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
That's right.
Saying,
but Tim Kaine with 250,000, Ben Cardin with 238,000, and Gene Shaheen with 200,000, they weren't far behind. By comparison, pro-Israel groups contributed only $5,000 to Rand Paul. You know, one doesn't say that money equals the vote, but I think with all of these votes, we have to be skeptical, and we especially have to be skeptical when lobbyists claim that our arguments are decisive. In fact, in today's paper, we have the head of the Tom Donohue, head of the Chamber of Commerce, saying with facts and arguments, we'll win this trade debate. This is about the Pacific trade deal. Mm-hmm. But we all know that the loudest facts and the most persuasive arguments for our senators are backed by money.
A lot of arguments going to be made. News coming out today that President Obama is inviting the heads of all the Gulf Cooperation
Cooperation Council countries as Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, to Camp David in the middle of May to talk about all of this with Iran and more. I want to turn to those
Tom, please, David. Before we leave it, just one quick point. Your caller was absolutely right. This is an executive agreement. There have been lots. Nixon's opening to China and so forth and so on. One thing makes this different. Congress put the U.S. sanctions, not the U.N. or European, but the U.S. sanctions in place against Iran. So only Congress can reverse that. And so that gives Congress a review right. It may be a few years down the line when the U.S. gets from the point of just lifting the sanctions by executive order to actually eliminating them. But that's what makes this agreement different.
And that traction is being grabbed pretty vigorously this week on Capitol Hill. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to get to those tax day wage protests Wednesday. Protesters around the country calling for a $15 an hour minimum wage, fast food places, and more. Here's a home care provider, Paula Gibbs, protesting outside of Burger King in Atlanta, explaining in an interview with WSB-TV that she needs that wage to take care of her family.
We go out every day to take care of everyone else's family so they can make a living wage. And all we're asking for is a living wage so we can take care of our families the same.
When you put it that way, it's kind of hard to deny. Let's get a caller from Atlanta. Jennifer in Atlanta, thank you for calling. You're on the air, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me. So I just had a comment about that. If you raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, it would be a shock to the economy, most likely, to do that, you know, overnight. But if you did that, people would better be able to support their families. I've worked with students in a local school that, you know, a lot of their parents, they don't have a lot of money. They can't support their children like they, you know, like to best do.
Yeah.
But about the implementation of that, it may be possible to reduce that shock to the economy if we did it over a number of years. You know, 5 or 10 years, it's a decent amount of time, of course. But if you did it that way, we'd be better prepared for the economic, you know, ramifications of such an increase. But if you did it, you know, a certain amount every year to raise the minimum wage to $15, not only would it help people, but it would help the economy in the end because people with more money spend money.
Get it on the way, at least. Jennifer, I see a note here that you are, as we speak, in a Walmart shopping. Is that true?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
And a few more dollars in the pocket might mean a little more commerce in the country. Jennifer, I appreciate your call from Atlanta. Let me get one more. Columbia, South Carolina. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I disagree with the last caller that it would be a shock to the economy. Economists pretty much agree that an increased minimum wage would be good. There was a great TED talk by a guy named Nick Hanauer, who is a self-proclaimed plutocrat, who basically goes on to say that the pitchforks are going to be coming for the plutocrats if they don't start to realize the error of their ways and start taking care of the people that they then employ. So there seems to be a culture of kind of competition between all of the mega rich to see how much they can squeeze out of their employees and then how much they can spend that on themselves. Kind of who's got the biggest yacht, who's got the biggest car, who's got the nicest this or that.
Tony, we got it. There's plenty of that out there. My time is short, but I really appreciate your call as well. Rachel, are these protests having an impact on Capitol Hill? We've seen some companies begin to raise their wages. McDonald's a little bit in some of its outlets. Is Congress listening to this? Is it persuasive?
I think between Iran and the trade deal this week and the Loretta Lynch fight, Congress is maxed out at the moment in terms of its attention span, which, as we all know, is somewhat limited to begin with. Where we're more likely to see it catch on quickly, I think, is, again, the 2016 race. We saw a Hillary Clinton tweeting in support of the protesters, or at least voicing support without specifically endorsing a minimum wage number, but saying every American deserves a fair shot at success. I think both on this issue, the question of minimum wage, and the trade deal that we're seeing President Obama at odds with the Democratic base, she is going to have a very challenging time positioning herself on those issues. She's going to have to make a bit of a choice whether she wants to go with the progressives in the party or the centrists in the party. This is a part of what her challenge was the last time around, that she she didn't navigate successfully. So the minimum wage fight, while she's voiced support for the protesters, this is more Elizabeth Warren's wing of the party than Hillary Clinton's wing of the party. And we'll be watching to see how she navigates all that.
Another interesting statement this week at a Sunday Mass for the centenary of mass killings in Armenia, Pope Francis describing that World War I era slaughter by Ottoman Turks as the first genocide of the 20th century. Diplomatic confrontation ensued with Turkey. They reject the term genocide. Here's the Pope, interpreted by Reuters.
La nostra umanità.
In the past century, our human family has lived through three massive and unprecedented tragedies.
Grande tragedie inaudite. La prima, quella...
The first, which is widely considered the first genocide of the 20th century, struck your own Armenian people.
Jack Beatty, this Pope continuing to be bold and with an eye on Christians in the Middle East suffering right now, dead in no small numbers.
Yes, and dead in massive numbers in 1915. You know, the Times story today brings out that only 9% of Turks think that the government should call what happened a genocide or apologize for them. That's shocking. So long. It's so long after the fact. It's a legacy of shame and disgrace. And someday the Turks have to face up to it.
More anniversaries we want to remember this week of the Oklahoma City bombings 20 years ago coming up. And, of course, the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln 150 years ago this week. What a towering figure. Let's draw some inspiration from that man, that leader. Grateful to all three of you for being with us today. David Sanger, national security correspondent with the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be back with you.
Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. Thanks for being here, Rachel.
Great to be here. Thanks so much, Tom.
And Jack, great to have you as always, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, On Point Radio. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point. Thank you.